Australian True Crime. The live show is coming.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
The producers of this podcast recognize the traditional owners of the land on which it's recorded. They pay respect to the Aboriginal elders past, present, and those emerging.
The following podcast contains accounts of child sexual assault. Listener discretion is advised.
I got a mate of mine, Professor Ian Coyle, he does trauma reports, and his stats on me were 1,000,000 to 1. He said, you know, looking back on where you come from now, to say up against that low socioeconomic area, you've done 23 years, you're sexually abused, you're a $1,500 a day heroin addict. And he said, you're 1,000,000 to 1 shot.
Russell Manser is an extraordinary man. He's been in and out of prison since he was literally a child. And when he wasn't inside, he was robbing banks to support a raging heroin habit. As we know, lifestyles like that don't come out of nowhere. And when Russell Manser decided to face the truth of what had happened to him, it changed his life. And since then, he's changed many other people's lives too. You may have noticed we've shared an episode of Russell's own podcast with you this week too. It's called The Stick Up, and we're very jealous because his guest is Mick Gatto, who we've tried to get on this show for many years without any luck, but it's a great interview and it's a great podcast. This is a very upsetting story involving serious sexual assault. We've talked around these issues before with other guests, but Russell is uncompromisingly honest in the way he tells his own story. So please take this as another content warning.
I grew up in Mount Druitt. It's not the end of the earth, but you can see it from there. My parents are English immigrants from Liverpool, England, came out in 65, and the Queen Mary, with four kids that were born in Liverpool, England, me and my brother were born in Liverpool, Australia, and, you know, and we grew up in a housing commission house, a fibro house with asbestos roof that was just like an oven in the summer. My dad worked in a factory. My mum worked in a plastic factory of a night shift. So, you know, I was self-sufficient. I was cooking for myself at 5 years old. You know, my mates would come over and I'd be standing on a chair cooking eggs and toast and, you know, they thought I was a great little chef and, you know, I'd be cooking for half the street. So I was self-sufficient for a young age. And man, my parents were really good people who'd just done their best. I'm doing a lot of work on this sort of stuff. I don't know if it was abandonment issues or anything like that, but I had to grow up really quick. I love my mum. She was such a beautiful, you know, but the nurturing side of things wasn't that great because of, you know, I used to see my mum on a weekend. That was it. But I was one of these kids that I would never go to school unless I knew my mum was safe. She'd come home from work and I'd give her a kiss and she'd get home from work at 8 o'clock and then I'd run to school from there, you know. That's the type of kid I was. I was very, really responsive to affection and stuff like that. There was a lot of fear on that when I think back to it. And I don't think fear is a great way for kids to grow up. I was always one of those kids, always escaping my environment, dreaming of different other things and, you know, and I remember as a kid, I had an awareness of, I'd see these people at the bus stops and at 6 o'clock in the morning and just looking miserable. But then I'd see the blokes coming home from jail and boys' homes and that being treated like war heroes and they were celebrated. The fathers would push the door out, there, Cheryl, that's the type of bloke you want to marry. He'll look after you. At least you'll have a good life with him. And that's how it was back then. And my idols were like, you know, the crims. They were driving Mercedes and Jags and the latest cars and wearing the best. And, you know, and my family took them 4 years to pay off a Datsun 180B. That looked romantic to me, these guys driving, you know, coming home from prison, looking fit and, you know, getting around with the best looking girls. But it was seasonal, you know, you'd see them one season, they were gone the next and gone for years at a time. And then you'd see the wife at the bus stop with the kids heading to Parramatta Jail or Long Bay or anything like that for years on end. By the time I was about 10 years old, my brother was a spray painter, panel beater, was doing cars up and that at home, and I wanted to do that. So seeing all these kids coming around and stealing cars, and that looked rock star to me. By the time I was 12, I was sort of joyriding in cars, and by the time I was 14, I was starting to drive them, and that's when my trouble began. I got in a police chase and crashed the car. Back then, there was no diversion programs like, you know what I mean, probation or anything like that. You went before the courts 6 months and off you go. And I went into boys' home and then I went out to Darick. Darick was like, it was just a crazy, crazy place. It was like pedophile's paradise. Here I was this underdeveloped, maybe 40 kilo. You know, as soon as I got that old, I'm from Mount Druitt and they were calling me a little surfy because I had a big mop of blonde hair and been out in the sun and they were calling me a surfy. And I was like, who are they calling a surfy? I'm not a fucking surfy. I got put into, like, because they've got these four houses there and there's like big dormitories and that sort of stuff. All of Mount Druitt kids were there. So it was like going back and giving them updates on how their family, like, you know, it was like news back on the front. It was like going to the front line in war and everyone wants to know how their brothers and they said, did you see my brother or you see my mum or whatever? One of the kids was sort of said, man, some bad things happen in this place. And I didn't sort of take too much on it. And then overnight time, you're in these dormitories and then there's like an office and the officers can see all the kids in the beds. And I was sort of aware that something wasn't right and you've seen these officers walking out and grabbing kids and then walking them into the toilet blocks. Over a period of time, I started to see people that didn't work there either. I later think there was a pedophile ring happening out of there amongst the officers. And so about the second or third night, someone grabs me and they say, come in here, go into the, they called an ablutions box, which is a shower and toilet and that sort of thing. I was sexually abused that night by two officers. I can remember one of them just had the most stinkiest breath. Like he just, like to basically get me to do what he wanted him to do, he'd breathe on me and it was like sewer breath. And it just rattled me. From there on in, it was just a really, going back to my bed after it and just getting put in, it was just this, like, this void that opened up in me. It was a really dark place. Something that created in me was really darkness in my stomach and I remember there was these old matrons and these matrons used to come in, you know, like old grandmothers, you know, and you think you can tell them anything and they're soft and they come in to make sure you had your clothes and stuff like that. You had like a uniform that you had to wear. And I said, you know, I've got, you know, this officer's done bad things to me. And she said, don't tell lies about him. All you little fellas, you little bastards are trying to say these officers are done. She goes, you're a little pack of liars. And I went, oh. I wasn't just expecting it because she was like this old, warm looking, and then she just turned into this ogre. So, you know, and over a period of time, that happened a few times to me. And then one time I ran away. Where the boys' home was, it was about 10K. So I ran home, and my dad was really sick with emphysema. And I ran home and I just with the every intentions of telling them what was going on. And I went in there and I just went, I can't. I've got five brothers and a sister, and it's that masculinity thing. And it's like back then that when them kids thought, you know, you think it was gay, you know what I mean? And I'm not homophobic or anything, but you can't differentiate as a young boy when a male perpetrator does something to you and not being gay. There's a big difference, I know, you know, but back then you just think, I've just performed a gay act. And just I looked at my dad and I just couldn't do it. The boys' home had been to my family house and said, if he hands himself in, we won't get the police involved. So my mum and dad said, we'll drive you back out there. You know, I reluctantly went back out there. And then they had this thing that was called the boob, and it's like an isolation cell. Down at Windsor, in the middle of winter, it gets like -2, and there's nothing in there. There's like a can to go to the toilet in, and no blankets or anything, like just the cold floor. Strip you naked and put you in there. So all night you're jogging on the spot. Two of them come in and sexually abuse me again.
How old were you?
14, turning 15. I got out of there. I never smoked pot or anything. I was never a drug user. Like a lot of my mates were smoking pot, and it never appealed to me because the smoking aspect, I was really anti against cigarettes. And I remember trying pot for the first time and thinking that sort of numbed me, you know. Like I remember these boys were smoking pot in the underpass. It wasn't long after I got out. Once again, I get out like a celebrated war hero and everyone's patting me on the back, good on you, mate. And then I'm in this, walking in this underpass, just going for a walk, and this bloke said, yeah, try this. And in the past, that wouldn't have appealed to me, but anything, I would have cut my toe off if that void would have went, you know what I mean? If someone said, cut that toe off and that thing would go away. And he said to me, this will make you feel better. And it was like he knew what I was going through. And so I smoked this pipe and that felt all right. And then I'd become a regular pot user. And one of the things I learned at Derry Boys Home was how to steal Porsches. You know, it was like a college. Yeah. It was like a college of knowledge. And I learned how to steal it. I could steal a Porsche in 45 seconds. So, you know, over a period of time, I tried to straighten my life out. I tried working as an apprentice chef, and I just wasn't. This void thing was just ugly and ugly. And my sleep, and even to today, my partner will tell you that I'm a horrible sleeper because of the time the abuse was late at night, and I have nightmares to this day. But it just wasn't happening. Everything I was doing wasn't working. You know, I'm trying to work. I worked in racehorse stables. I tried everything I could do as that form of escapism, and it just didn't work. One day, one of the boys I was in the boys' home, we've got out of the boys' home, so let's go and steal a Porsche. And I was there with bells on. So we went over this affluent area in Sydney called Whale Beach, and we stole a 930 twin turbo Porsche. And everything's like fucking fighter jets. They're just unbelievably quick. And at the time, there was a kid called Scotty Simpson. They called him the Turbo Kid, and he was getting all this publicity because he was stealing Porsches and going out front of Balmain Police Station and revving the car up and waiting until the police come out and taking off. And he became this urban hero, you know. I was in the front pages of the paper. And this was at the time that I stole a Porsche and stole this Porsche. I was going up this road where I'd been up a few times before. It was French's Forest Road, and it was one of the darkest roads in Sydney. It was really light. And my mate opened the sunroof and there's a police helicopter on top of us, you know. And it was the first time they brought the police helicopter in to get this Turbo Kid. It was the first time they'd ever used it and catching someone that was on ours. And I'm going, fucking wow, you know. So we're trying to shake him and we couldn't shake him. We went down this street and ended up running into Sydney Harbour and trying to swim away, and we got caught by the water police. Yeah. And so I ended up at Manly Police Station. Anyway, long story short, I ended up before Bajura Children's Court the next day. And this lawyer, like, that's my distrust. The lawyer came from this bloke. It just was massive. And he didn't warn us what was going to go down. He said, just plead guilty. You'll get 3 months. You'll have to go to the boys' home. And I was thinking, okay. And then the judge sentenced us and he said, his words were, how dare you come from Mount Druitt and steal a Porsche from an affluent area? You know, it was like a class crime. How dare you have the audacity to do that? And he said, I'm going to sentence you to 12 months and I stipulate it gets served in an adult prison. Oh. I thought it was joking. I just thought, oh, yeah, of course, yeah, dickhead. And then, yeah, we got handcuffed and we jumped in a bull wagon driving out to Long Bay. And I said to my mate, this ain't, because the boys' home for us to go, I was 16 by that stage, the boys' home would have been Mount Penang up at Gosford. I said, this is a funny way to go to Gosford. And then we got to Long Bay, the gates opened, and then we got in and, you know, they wanted strip searches, and I said, strip searches, you know. It's funny because I look at them people today and I just think, they were thinking it's funny. And they were sort of saying, spread your ass cheeks, jump down and cough and everything like that. They seem to be getting some sick joy out of it. And then give me these oversized green clothes and said, come up here. And I had a mattress and I went to a cell and there was two cards and it says someone's name in the sentence they're doing them. And so there's two cards, put me there and they said, open the door and there's two blokes in bunks. One was about 45 and one was about 35. And then they slammed the door and before they said anything, they said, have fun, boys. I was laying on the floor because my mattress was on the floor. And I could see our mate masturbating underneath. He had his knee up and I could see him jerking off. And then he just said, get up here. And he said, do something with this. And then our mate leaned down from the top and he goes, mate, you do it the easy way or the hard way. So once again, sexually abused. And I was there with another bloke and he came out in the morning. I seen he had tears in his eyes and that. And then when I went down, like you go to this muster area, it was this bloke and he just looked like a creep. He had these dark Coca-Cola bottle glasses. He had like hair on his back was sticking out of his T-shirt. And his name was Jeff Hardy. He was a notorious necrophiliac and he was just zooming in on me. And I got the worst feeling from this guy ever. And he said, where are you? And I told him where I was. He said, you'll have to come and stay. And I was just thinking, fuck, what is it? It was like it was hell. Later that day, he said, come around. Like, he had this cell and I ran it back there. And he said, I'll give you something to make you feel better. And I said, I don't want it. And he said, mate. And he just growled at me. He said, just get around here and get it and give me a shot of heroin for the first time I'd ever had heroin. It was like the syringe was cut down or had a, like a piece of thong for the plunger and an old nail to pull it back. It was like disgusting. And he gave me that. And then my first reaction was heroin. I got sick and I wanted to vomit. And that's when as I was vomiting into the toilet, that's where he sexually abused me. And then in jail, how you see senior screws has got these things, they're like a pip. You see the coppers have got them, they've got like pips on their shoulders and it says that, you know. So you got a fair idea that they're senior management. And I seen one guy, once again, he had that old grandfather look about him and I said, man, this ain't good here. I said, we're kids and I don't think we're meant to be here. And he goes, and he said, how are you fine? And I said, you've been sexually abused. And then later I looked over and here he was talking to the necrophiliac, telling him what I must have said. So it made my life hell there. And then about 6 weeks later, I'll get what's called a Section 94, which means I was getting transferred from Long Bay back to Mount Penang Boys Home.
So those 6 weeks, you're 16.
Yeah.
Did that continue on?
Yeah, it did. It was an ongoing process.
You were just consistently raped.
Yeah. It was an ongoing process there.
In Long Bay with full knowledge of
the stuff. You know what? But what it was one wing at the Central Industrial Prison at Long Bay housed the worst sex offenders in Australia at the time, right? It's not like today, like they've got the protection wings and out. Some blokes just can't fight or scared or whatever, they go in there. But this was just like it was like worst sex offenders, corrupt cops, police informers, corrupt screws or whatever. And that's what it was. It was a wing of about 120 people, the worst degenerates in the state at the time. In their best way of thinking, they thought housing me would be the safest place for me to be. And how do you come to that conclusion? If child safety were aware of a kid going a housing block, they would, like, you know, they've got these housing blocks where they house sex offenders or something like that. They wouldn't allow it. They wouldn't allow it, but they allowed that. That lawyer should have said, mate, you can't do it.
I was just thinking about the number of adults involved, actually. I was thinking about the prosecution lawyer, the defence lawyer, the judge, the staff at the prison.
You know, I've backtracked since then and looked, that process was totally illegal, what they done to me.
Barbaric.
Totally illegal. And if you think sexually abusing children is going to be a deterrent for offending behaviour, you are so wrong. If you think that, you know, we'll let the pedophiles do our justice for us, you know, you've got a pretty sick mind.
So you ended up, they transported you to Mount Penang.
Mount Penang. I'd done about 8 months up there. I was sort of given privileged treatment up there because I was like, you know, they knew what had happened to me and they didn't really want that getting out. There was abuse going on up there, but I got kept out of it. But be honest, at that stage, if they would have tried on me, I'd had enough and I was willing to kill someone. I got to that stage and I developed something I'd never had. I had developed a propensity for violence.
Oh, of course.
As a defence mechanism.
Yeah.
Well, as a trauma coping response. But I won't, and I still am today, I'm the person that really looks after themselves physically and it's always trained. And part of that, I think, subconsciously is always just never allowing that to be vulnerable and being willing to fight. And I sort of made that clear when I got to Mount Penang. Yeah, I got out and I just, man, by this stage, my mum had moved from Mount Druitt to Liverpool, which is close to Cabramatta. That's when the heroin epidemic was kicking off at Cabramatta. So, you know, I was aware of it. I knew heroin filled the void, made me feel good. And off I'd go to Cabramatta, get on, and just this routine of drug use and offending behaviour. And, you know, the next time I ended up in a mainstream prison, I was safe as houses. It was like that, people look down on people like that, you know what I mean? So, yeah, so I went on this 23-year cycle of drug use. And, like, people say, what's heroin withdrawal like, right? I'll tell you what it's like. Think of your worst flu that you've ever had and times it by 10. That would be the closest way you could describe heroin withdrawal. So you wake up hanging out. I used to have loaded syringes in my milk cartons, like already I didn't want to even go through the process of mixing, like the mixing up. You get, it comes in a powder form. You put it in a spoon or a Coke can or something. You hit it with water and then you mix it up and then you suck it up the syringe and then you inject it. I used to have them already pre-made because I didn't want to even have to go through the process of mixing it up.
And when you wake up in the morning, you wanted to know it was ready.
Because, look, what you're hiding from and what you're using for is waiting for you when you open your eyes. All of that horrible stuff, that void is there sitting there and it's amplified. It's really amplified and it's real and it's got a voice and it's loud. And so you wake up to that and that's part of the addiction itself. You know, I mean, the addiction knows to use that to keep you going. And it's like, oh, it's like it's on a loudspeaker, all that shame and that guilt and that embarrassment that's there waiting for you. So you want to get that syringe in your arm as quick as you can to avoid that because it's loud. It's so loud.
We received a lot of messages a little while back after we spoke to Vanessa Valentine, and we thought this one was a good message to share during Russell's episode.
The part one of Vanessa Valentine's podcast, I could have been listening to my own story in so many ways. The similarities are freakishly accurate, especially about trauma and heroin. It's amazing how many people think that heroin addicts are just pieces of shit that have grown up in the worst possible ways, when there's so many of us that are just little kids that have suffered from trauma and abuse and are looking for that numbness. And it's a hard place to come out of.
Thank you so much for that. We love receiving your voice messages. And there's also a link on our Facebook page.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home,
you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
I was up to no good. I was on a plane going to Perth, and I was reading a book called Sleepers, which is the Kevin Bacon movie about kids that were abused in a home and they square up on their abusers. And I was reading it, and there was a bloke sitting behind me. You know when you can feel someone staring at you? And he said, that book, he goes, why are you reading it? And I just blurted it out, and I said, it's the story of my life. I told him I'd spent a whole heap of time in boys' homes and jails and everything like that. And he told me about the Royal Commission. He was part of the Royal Commission. And Institution Responses to Child Sexual Abuse. So he was part of that, and he was telling me it was kicking off. That was in 2013. I think it might have even kicked off by then, or it was kicking off. And I thought nothing of it. I went on a bank robbing spree, and I robbed a heap of Suncorp Metways from North Sydney to the Gold Coast, and I ended up getting caught coming out of one on the Gold Coast. And I was at Southport Watch House, and I was a Tasmanian tiger, because they've got these blinds on the cells, cell windows, and it was like all these people are peeping through, and it's like they've seen a Tasmanian tiger. First, none of them had ever seen a bank robber before, because that was
Bank robbers around by then.
Yeah. Nah, 2014, they were long gone. The party was over, but I kept on turning up. And so long story short, I had every intention of going to jail and knocking myself. It's funny when you make peace with something like that. It's like, this is what I'm going to do, because I've got two sons, and I just got sick of hurting them and disappointing them. And I just had enough. I was so badly beaten. You get to prison, you've got a coaxial cable part of your TV, not necessarily a TV, but you always got a coaxial cable. So that's what I was going to do. And when I got to the cell that night, prisoners are really ingenious people. They'll make a cigarette lighter out of a coaxial cable. They'll get the wire out of it and stick it into the two power points and spark. And so they'd cut it down to make a lighter out of it. So the coaxial cable that was there wouldn't have wrapped around my little toe, let alone my neck. So I had to put it off. I had to put the process off of killing myself. I said, "All right, well, I'll do it tonight. When they get out, I'll get it right." And then, so in the morning, in the jail cells in Queensland, they've got like a 30-centimeter display window where people can look in and screws can sort of see if you're all right. And this bloke came to my window, who I suspected of being a sex offender previously, and I'd had some run-ins with. And he offered me a shot of heroin. He said, "You know, I know that you and I haven't never seen eye to eye, but this is like a peace deal." He said, and that was in a dirty old syringe, and that wouldn't have bothered me in the past. And I looked at him and I banged the window. I said, "No matter how bad I was feeling, no matter how low I ever got, I said, I could never take nothing off of you because you're a piece of shit." And I said, "And if you don't get away, I'll bash you when I come out." And I was in no physical shape to bash anyone. And then so I got out. I walked down in the unit, and like the unit's set out and it's got some tables, and there's a young fella down, he's got all these books out. And I said, "What are you doing?" He said, "I'm studying to be a psychologist." He said, "I took your advice all those years ago." And he said, "And I'd done something. I started, you know, I'd done tertiary preparation. And I'm studying to be a psychologist." And he looked me up and down with disdain. I can remember this look. And he said, "Maybe you should take your own advice," and then just got back to his studying. And I went, oh, that hurt. And then, so I was walking back from the legal visit, education was open, I ducked in, I said, "What do you got, like, what's available?" And they said, "Why don't you do tertiary prep? What would you like to do?" I said, "Like, maybe study law or something like that." And they said, "Well, do tertiary prep." And tertiary prep, how they program tertiary prep in Queensland is they pick what you want to study and they mould it to what you're going to study at uni, so you get passed for uni. So within a period of, say, 12 hours, something sparked in me morally. I wouldn't take something off a sex offender. Secondly, and then I'll give some kid an advice that, change his trajectory. And I wasn't going to do that long. And there's a little bit, you know, there was something, a goal with education. And I said, "You know what? If I'm going to do this, you know, I'm going to be committed. I've got to be fully committed." And one of the things that come up is I'd got to that point where I knew the underlying issue of my drug use and the suicidal ideology and stuff like that was the abuse itself. And I had to do something about that. And, you know, TV, first thing I'd do, 7:30 report comes on, they're chasing George Pell.
Shut up.
Yeah.
Wow.
It's like roadmaps, like signposts along the way.
There it is. And I go, wow. And I like, are they going to chase him? And I was thinking, wow. The next day I jumped on the phone, got a phone number, and I wrote to the Royal Commission. I just wrote a one-page foolscap paper, and I thought, if I hear from them, I hear from them, you know, and if I don't, I don't. And then 2 weeks later they call me out for a legal visit. When you're in jail, you got a yard with 60 people in it and people know everything you're talking about and people getting sus on me, they're thinking I was talking to the police or something like that. So I had to do a declaration and call the whole yard in and say, hey, look, I'm not talking to the police. I'm talking to Royal Commission about being sexually abused as a child. After it, a whole, like, I just got basically a standing ovation of 60 blokes, like, wow, they're blown away.
I mean, I feel like I've just met you, but I feel like that sort of encapsulates your power. You stood in that yard and you said something that's so many people can't say. And there's a reason why. What we found out in that Royal Commission is that it takes the average victim 33 years to disclose their abuse, and you're a tough man. And for you to stand in that yard and say that in front of all those blokes unlocked something for all of them. It's really hard to say what you said.
Oh, look, I was sort of taken back because that sort of thing's not easy. And I sort of felt like I'd been pressured into it by the way corrective services had things set up. Because that could have went wrong for me. Yeah. You know what I mean? People could have said, oh, you're being a dog, you're being an informer. But I had to stand my ground, and I was willing to stand my ground and fight my way out of it if I had to. But was totally the opposite. How I felt about it, it was trepidation. It was like, whew, it was a big, deep breath, and it was like, I'm going to have to say this. Normally when you organise a yard meeting, and take in mind that when you do that, the officers want to be involved too. So I had to say it in front of two officers as well, 60 inmates plus two officers. And I had to do that, and there was fear. But I'll tell you what, I tell my story a lot these days, and every time I tell it, it's become cathartic for me. And I realised the anxiety I had about not telling my story was way greater than the relief of actually telling my story. Now, when you get called for a legal visit in jail, you go up there, you've got anxiety because it could be the police with new charges or anything. So you're really reluctant. Yeah, who are you? What are you? And they said, we're from the Royal Commission. I said, Royal Commission, what? And then I remembered, sat down. She goes, firstly, I want you to understand, we believe you.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. How did that feel?
Oh, man, it was sort of because previously when you report the abuse, they say, oh, go away, you little liar, you're being manipulative, and that person wouldn't do this or that person wouldn't do that. So, yeah, and then I had about a 40-minute talk with her and straight into a trauma counsellor. And I was crazy. And this little English woman ended up being my trauma counsellor for 4 years, and I never ever met her over the phone. And we just went through some amazing, some pretty amazing stuff. It was a really big turning point in my life to finally have someone say, look, you know, we believe you. Like, what? When she said that, I was like, yeah, of course you do, because I doubted it. And then she said, look, there's indicators from that institution that back up what you're saying. I carried a backpack of stuff that didn't belong to me, and that's guilt, shame, anger, embarrassment. And when I tell my story, I hand it back to its rightful owner, and that's the perpetrator themselves. A perpetrator's greatest weapon is his victim's silence and shame. I had 2 weeks to go, I was getting parole, and the cop was coming to charge me with 6 old bank robberies, right? So anyway, so I was out for I went to a rehab. I'd done the rehab program. I went into an outreach, which meant I lived in the community near the rehab, so I had my own unit. I kicked off the Voice of the Survivor. The Voice of the Survivor was going for about 12 or 18 months, and I had the front court on these charges. And it was one of those days where I went to Downing Centre Court and District Court. We had I'd done more research, and the judge we had was a whacker. He'd give big sentences out. And this day he had too much on, so he had to pass my case on to another judge, and he passed my judge onto a civil liberties type judge who was compassionate and kind. And he had a jury out, so he had enough time to sentence me. And so he could fit me in for a few hours. In his sentencing comments, he said, you know, if this abuse never happened to you, he said, I have no doubt you've got a business acumen, you would have been a CEO of a multinational company. And he said, to sentence you to prison today would be doing a disservice to the community. He said, because once you were a public enemy, he said, now today you're a community asset. He talked about, because, you know, I had the apology letter from the government and the stuff that I'd done with the Royal Commission and my statement of facts of everything that happened to me. And he said to me, he said, you had things done to you as a child that were beyond your control. And he said, that changed the trajectory of your life. He said, in another life, you could have been anything else other than what you become. And he said, you've been taken before the courts and you've been told how bad you were without people knowing what happened to you. And he said,
without people caring what
yeah.
happened to you.
Yeah. But to have that judge sort of say to me, it was sort of, I don't know, it was redemption. It was like, it was, that was a real big part of the healing process, I have no doubt, to be recognised by the courts. Richard Pontello and Peter O'Brien were my lawyers and barristers, and they said they were the best sentence and comments they'd ever heard in their 30-year-plus practising law.
But a lot of other blokes, a lot of other people still would feel bitterness. Like, your ability to not sacrifice your life to bitterness and to move on and work for others, and, you know, I think that's what's special.
Yeah, because it wasn't
you.
Serving me. I wasn't. Yeah. I had that bitterness for a long time, and part of trauma counselling and that sort of thing, it was how well was it serving me? I remember once my trauma counsellor went in one day and she goes, I've got a plan. And I said, oh, I'm always up for a plan. What's the plan? She goes, we're going to kill a pedophile today. And I went, oh, fuck, I'm there with bells on. And we'd done the stats on it. And she goes, okay, so where, do you know where one would be? I said, I reckon I could jump a few fences and get the one. This was whilst I was in prison. She goes, okay, do you reckon you get? I said, yeah, I could get in the yard. And she said, what would you do? I said, oh, I'd have to stab him or cut his head off. I said, all right, well, I'm down with that. And then she starts doing the stats. She goes, so how many people in it? You know, I said 60. She goes, how many people would tell you, oh, I'm at 155, maybe 60, you know, because they were in a putrid wing. I said, is there many cameras? And she was breaking it down statistically. And she was going, so oh, you're up to about 100% chance of getting caught. She goes, now you're going to get caught, and the courts don't like people taking, you know, the law into their own hands, and you're going to get 20 years. And now, so what's the effects of that going to happen on you? And she said, what about your kids and how old are they? And, you know, so we've done this massive breakdown. And she goes, do you reckon it's worth, do you still want to do it? And it's like, nah. For how long does it make you feel? It make me feel good for about 20 minutes and then make me feel bad for 20 years. And post 20 years, because of all of that jail trauma that you pick up along the way. So it's actually 10 years of getting out of the jail trauma. So for 30 years worth of, you know, it's like having a shot of ice, you know, it feels good for 10 minutes and fucking wrecks your life, you know.
And instead you're out here helping all of these men, every man who rings you and says.
Men and women. We do men and women.
Well, every person who says to you, you're the only person I can trust.
And that's leadership.
When I got out of prison, I had some goals. I'm going to work 12 hours a day for 2 years straight and see where it takes me. I know even if I would have got a job in McDonald's, I would have ended up in front with a massive tax bill. But, and that's what I did. I got out and I just worked, right? But I also done a lot of things. I've done a lot of NA meetings. I always had time for that. I always had time for self-nurturing stuff like counselling and gym. Like health and fitness has always played a big part in my mental health. I'd done that and I just laid a really good pathway. And I always said, I want to be able to work from the beach. Mm-hmm. Right? I do that today. Like, you know, my phone's my office. I'm normally juggling two phones, and my mate's got two phones. He juggles on my behalf as well. So I've got peace. I think that's the ultimate, you know.
What about that big black hole that you're talking about?
I've filled it. Obviously, love has filled that. That, like, that's played a big part in filling it with love and memories. Like, really, I've created, like, I saw a talk of people about getting compensation. I said, use your compensation to create some memories, you know, and create some good memories. They don't, you know what I mean? Because these people, by the time they tell their stories, they've got, it's pretty dark, it's pretty horrific. And, you know, I remember one guy, they give him special exempts. They let him go a year early because he had liver cancer. So we timed it, so he got his payout. And he died. He rang me 2 weeks before he died. He said, you know what? He said, I just want to thank you. He said, because I got to create some good memories. I went a few holidays with my kids. And so, you know, life was pretty bad. He said, but I got to create some good memories with my kids. And I don't know what sort of price you put on that. Like, I've done all the material stuff, worked my ass off, and I've been able to get the material stuff. And that's not rewarding for me. That's nothing to do with my purpose these days. My purpose is to help people begin that healing journey. And that in itself, just, I don't know if it's a karma thing or whatever, but I get rewarded pretty good for it. I've got a pretty good lifestyle, live on the Gold Coast. You know, I get to do what I like to do. I travel a lot from work. Like on the moment, we're here in Melbourne. Tomorrow we're in Hobart, and then we're in Perth for a week, home for a couple. And just, I go everywhere, you know, and I meet some fascinating, interesting people, do these podcasts, and I've met some interesting people through that. I've got two kids, got an amazing supportive partner, and we'll travel this year. I'm actually getting married, do all of that sort of stuff.
Is your mum still living?
No, my mum passed away in March last year.
Oh, so that recently?
Yeah, yeah.
Did you still have a relationship with her?
Oh, amazing.
Oh, yeah. That's beautiful.
Yeah, she got to see things like
That's so great.
I bought a farm near Byron. I bought a 15-acre farm near Byron Bay.
Wow.
And she got to see a video of that. Yeah, life's good. You know, and I've got a purpose. My purpose, you know, obviously helping survivors, but I'm really passionate about changing our prisons around. Like, I'm getting involved in training staff.
Prison staff.
Yeah, prison staff. Mm. So my question to them is, why would you want to do a job where your intention is to go and traumatise already traumatised people? What reward's in it for that? Because I'll tell you the rewards that's in it for you. You'll go in and see your workmates that take that look. You'll have a look at their lives. You'll see their wives hate them, their kids hate them.
Yep.
They live a miserable existence. Mm. The dog hates them. I'll tell you an interesting thing that happened to me. I'd been talking to the Royal Commission in Queensland. I've been up there for about three years and went for all that trauma counselling. And I come down to New South Wales and I was in the prison. And they do the prison cell ramps and everything like that. And I turn up with a dog. And there was about four of them. They put a set of handcuffs on you, handcuff you behind your back. They get your strip search. And he put this thing in my hands. It was a piece of plastic, right? And it was to spread my ass cheeks. And he said, put that between your ass cheeks. I said, I put it between my ass cheeks. And I dropped that. And he picked it up and tried putting it in. I said, I'm not putting it between my ass cheeks. That's sexual abuse. And he goes, what are you saying? I said, it's sexual abuse. He said, I'll break your jaw. I said, break my jaw. I said, I don't give a fuck. Yeah, and then the dog's going off its head because I got a dog. And they said, skitch the dog. And I said, skitch the dog. And I said, I'm not fucking allowing you to sexually abuse me. I said, it's not happening. I'm friends with the Assistant Commissioner of Corrective Services, and I used to be a clerk for him at Long Bay, and he made his way to Commissioner, and we just got this amazing friendship. I asked him, is that part of process? He said, no, they'll rack them on their own. He said, whatever they're doing, he said, that's not part of protocol. So when they take that view that they feel like they can do that sort of stuff and, I don't know, go rogue.
Or dominant, isn't it? It's about dominating you.
And humiliating you.
Yeah.
They're getting power in a job because they do not have power anywhere else.
Yeah,
on it.
Crazy. I was at Goulburn once and this officer was sitting, he was ramping my cell. So I give him a commentary. I said, I know you. I know what you're about. And he's looking at me going, oh, yeah, okay, Dr. Phil, give it to me. And I said, I'll tell you what it is. I said, you go home, your wife sees you pulling the driveway, she dreads you coming in that house.
Mm-hmm.
You sit on a lounge, you grab the remote control, you rift your ass cheeks up, you have a big fart. You're the only one who thinks it's funny. The dog sees you and fucking takes off and stays under the house until you go to work the next day. The kids are in the bedroom with their headphones on because they don't want to engage with you because you're so fucking miserable. And I said, you know, and then you get up and do it all again the next day. And I said, and you're the only one who thinks it's any good. And I said, but deep down, you know, you're a shit bag. You look in the mirror and you go, and you turn away. I said, because you can't stand that person that you are. And about 3 weeks later, he comes in and he goes, he's a bit teary. And he goes, fuck, you know what? You're right.
Wow.
And he goes, you are fucking right. And he goes, and how do you know about the dog? I said, mate, because you're just a horrible fucking person. And he goes, yeah, I know. And I said, but you can change that. That's up to you.
You're right. Happy people don't treat other people like shit.
No, you can't disassociate. You can't do that for 8 hours and go home and be normal. No. It just doesn't work that way.
No way.
So he said, how do I do it? I said, mate, just start today and fucking walk up to a prisoner and say, hey, mate, how are you? What can I do for you? And he went, what? I said, it's that simple. Start doing good things. Don't break the rules. And don't stretch the boundaries. Just do what you're employed to do. Mm. Jump on, do their case notes. Oh, you've got some courses. Call you, have you got in case load? He goes, I've got 25 of my case load. I said, call them all up today. And I'm hearing these names. Johnson, come to the office. Mark and Smith, come to the office. And they're all coming back to me going, what have you fucking said to him? I said, just be fucking nice. And I remember getting out from prison and he walked up and he said, oh, can I just walk out to the gas? Like some scene out of a fucking, I don't know, Shawshank Redemption or something like that, you know what I mean? And him walking up to the gate with me, he said, mate, I might have to give you a hug. Mm. And I went, oh. He goes, you saved my marriage. He said, because they were about to walk out and leave me. And he said, but I'm getting out of this job. He said, this ain't for me.
What amazes me often is we know that so many men came out of those places violent.
Mm.
That none of them went and killed those guys.
Yeah. Mm. I'll tell you a funny thing. I remember another time, I was walking my dog not long after I got out of Darick, and I was walking my dog and this bloke came up to me and grabbed me on the genitals and said something, but I ran away. And then was at Parramatta Jail in 1987, and you go to these reception cells to see who's new, and here he is. Here he is, and I ran because I wanted to get a like a wooden squash racket so I could club him with it. I went to my cell and I had like a paddle board, like you play squash against the wall. I ran to my cell again. I had one under my bed and I ran, and I'm running back. As I'm running out, these three blokes come out of his cell and they had balaclavas on, and they'd just bashed him and robbed him for his gold chain. So what happened is that guy that night, he, because he'd been bashed and he went to court and used that as a way to get out on bail, and it turns out it was him for raping his own kids. At Parramatta Jail, you can talk to people on the street. And he drove past and he stopped in his car and he yelled out to them guys. And he was saying their names. He said, "I'm going over to your house to rape your kids," you know. Anyway, that same guy, this was long after the Royal Commission. And I spoke to the Royal Commission when I was in jail in Queensland. And I'd come down to New South Wales on an interstate transfer. And I was at MRRC jail, which is a reception jail. It's massive. It's got about 2,000 people. And I'm on the walkway and I've got two screws walking with me. And here he is walking. And I froze. Don't know why, but I hesitated. And I never thought I would do that. I thought I would just attack. And I hesitated. And it's like you have those dreams and you can't run fast enough and you're running from something you can't and you've got no speed. I just wasn't there. And I was like, and I wanted to attack him. There was just something in me that just wouldn't allow him. I would have got jumped on, but I wouldn't have got to him firstly. That distance, I would have had to cover 15 metres to get to him and them screws. I don't know. Maybe not.
But it's your emotional reaction. Yeah. To freeze. No, that's what I was just thinking after I asked about it, after I said, why didn't they ever track down those guys and kill them? And then you started talking, I thought, oh, I suddenly realised because they're still frightening.
Yeah, the negrophiliac that abused me is apparently still alive. What happens, I've built a life these days for myself that I wouldn't gamble with.
No, but of course, but yeah, even on an emotional level.
I'd love to kill him. I'd stab his eyes out in a heartbeat.
Do you really think if you were ever in a room with him,
your emotional
reaction would be to go anywhere near him?
I think I could fuck with his head, like, for that, whatever it was, 10 minutes or something there, to let him feel the fear that I felt. Like, I'd be talking to him, I'm about to stab your eyes out and I'm going to cut your tongue off and your fingers off. And for that whatever period of time, I reckon I could make him feel the fear that I felt.
I think
it's... because it's that whole thing about resentments, right?
Yeah.
Resentment is the rust the vessel had contained in. Having a resentment with someone is like drinking a cup of poison and the other person dies for it.
I find it kind of heartbreaking when I think about it now, how infrequently victims actually commit revenge.
It doesn't happen, and it doesn't happen through the courts either.
No.
That, you know, they're just so well protected by the judicial system. And why? In social science, there's a thing called the mink coat theory, right? The mink coat gets stolen. It creates a stimulus because you're going to employ people to police, to chase it, judges, prison officers, parole officers. A pedophile creates prostitutes, criminal, you know, and the next drug addict, the next violent offender. So it keeps the chains of the judicial system rolling. They know that. If you took, say, pedophiles out of the equation, I reckon your prison system would be down by 60%, especially people with propensity for violence and drug use. I think the stats that are pretty evident these days, they're overwhelming. I mean, another stat we have at the Voice of a Survivor, we've got 15,500 clients, right? Well, psychiatrists will tell you that 75% of pedophiles were sexually abused as children. We haven't got one. So we dispel them stats. In a heartbeat, we told the universities, we've got these stats that'll dispel that. You know what I mean? How much more proof do you want? Pedophiles are that, they use it as mitigation. It happened to them. So, you know, I was just doing, you know, it's just passing on what happened to me.
Yep. I mean, I have learnt from you today that I think we're all aware that sexual assault happens in prison, but it honestly never occurred to me that it was used as punishment. It, honestly, and that's going to sound so naive to you.
Have you got to be, what sort of person, like an officer, like, man, I'm.
Yeah, I can't
what sort of it. What sort of person gets employed and we'll think that's kosher?
It's sadistic.
It is sadistic.
Yeah.
You know, and they're compliant. If you put an inmate in a cell with, an 18-year-old kid that's just got an attitude problem and he goes on and rapes him.
Yeah. You're responsible for you are as responsible for that.
Yeah, that's crazy. But the work I do with the voice of a survivor, I have the most violent people in Australia ring me, and they'll say, you know, and it makes sense. There's been a few over the years, and I go, "Poor that bloke, mate's hectic." And then all of a sudden, I'm getting a phone call from him. He goes, "Mate, you're the only one I trust with this story.
Yeah,
they know what I've done." And they, you know, they'll say, "You're the first person I ever told this to." And I, you know, and that's always that fear. Oh, I don't want anyone else to know. I said, "Well, mate, you, other people are going to know." Because, and but, and I talk about telling their story, beginning of the healing process and the healing journey. And, you know, talking about that saying I've got, you know, a perpetrator's greatest weapon is a victim's silence, shame, the backpack and the analogy and stuff like that. And they get it. They sit in a room with detectives and that. They're not, because they don't trust detectives. They don't trust prison officers. They don't trust lawyers. That's why what the work we do at the Voice of a Survivor works. We're the conduit for these people to tell their story for the first time in a safe platform. The cure to trauma is love. It is. It's without a doubt. Like, how you cure a traumatized person is love them back. It's like rehab, drug rehabilitation. You don't get in there fucking getting people clean by telling them what shitbags they are. You know, and that's that self-worth stuff. Survivors lack in this, like when most of their life is self-worth, what's happened to me is my self-worth, a few seeds and it grew. And my self-worth gradually come back. And today I don't doubt it. You know, today I don't doubt myself. Well, I'm a worthy person. I'm worthy of love. And I'm a good person. I'm not this bad person that I've been portrayed in the past. And when you know my story, you'll understand. I don't use my abuse as a justification for robbing banks and anything like that. I have genuine remorse. And I genuinely regret that. And I didn't understand trauma, what I'd done to other people, until I understood my own trauma. You know, I didn't understand, like, oh, how do you feel about them? I don't know how to feel about them.
No.
Because I had a whole heap of shit things done to me too, so they should just be kicking along like I do.
And, like, how do you respect society? How do you respect strangers like the security guard at the bank when you've been 16 and stood in a courtroom and had a judge, an adult, say, you know what, I'm going to send you to be raped for a couple of years in Long Bay. And then when you get there, the adult guard's there, specifically put you in rooms for that to happen. How do we expect you to then have respect for the rest of us?
Yeah.
You know, when your childhood has been blighted that way.
I got a mate of mine, Professor Ian Coyle, he does trauma reports, and his stats on me were 1,000,000 to 1.
Mm-hmm.
He said, you're 1,000,000. He said, you know, looking back on where you come from now, Drew, say up against that low socioeconomic area, you've done 23 years, you're sexually abused, you're a $1,500 a day heroin addict. And he said, you're 1,000,000 to 1 shot.
Thank you to our guest, Russell Manser. If this show has raised any issues for you that you'd like to talk to someone about, you can call Lifeline on 13 11 14 or you can visit their website, lifeline.org.au. Thank you for downloading this episode of Australian True Crime. We'll be back next week. Australian True Crime is recorded at the Hub Australia. Every Hub Australia co-working space has a fully equipped media studio, so you can make a podcast all of your own. Visit hubaustralia.com for more details.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
This has been another Smart Fella production in conjunction with the Acast Creator Network.
Australian True Crime. The live show is coming.